Faith, the 13th talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 18, 2006, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we're on page 16 of the outline. We're going to talk about faith. For years as a Bible teacher, I was persuaded by, for a variety of reasons, but I won't get into that, but I was persuaded that faith, or the Greek word pistis that is translated faith, actually would be better translated trust. I think Luther argues that, and many people since him have argued that. It wasn't until, now it's probably been 10 years ago, but a number of years ago that I set out to write a paper that I thought was going to kind of put my theology together finally. And for the first time in my life, I did a word study on pistis, it's translated faith, and it turned my world upside down in terms of my understanding of New Testament theology, because I learned, much to my surprise, that pistis, as it's used by the apostles, means not faith, but belief. Not trust, I should say. Not trust, but belief. It's the plain old ordinary variety word that you would use in Greek if what you wanted to do is describe what somebody believed about something. Tell them, give them an account, tell them a story, and if they believe it, they have pistis in relationship to that. They have belief about that. Well, that's the way it gets used in the New Testament. It doesn't, if ever, I'm not sure it ever does, but predominantly at least, it's used to describe the response of people when you proclaim the gospel, proclaim the facts about Jesus and your interpretation of those facts, and the significance of Jesus and his role. You proclaim those things to people. If they believe that what you're saying is the truth, then they have responded with what we translate as faith or belief. They have believed it. They have thought that it was true. So that's what we're talking about. So I've defined it here in your first point. Faith is an eager, believing response to the good news of the gospel and the story that it tells. It is the embracing of that story and its claims as true. That's what belief, faith is. The first thing we need to realize about that is that faith is a rational response to the evidence. Now that's probably somewhat controversial in our climate, and I don't think it's really all that well understood in the modern culture today, because we have grown accustomed, we've had hundreds of years of faith being proposed to us as some other kind of extra mode of coming to knowledge, an extra rational, non-rational, above rational, other than rational mode for coming to have a belief, for coming to have knowledge. And there's a variety of reasons for that. Maybe I'll rehearse some of those and get into some of that. But my contention is that that's wrong. That's false. Faith is not an extra rational mode of knowledge or belief. Faith is simply the act of having, in the face of the evidence, in the face of the reasons for believing, deciding that I'm going to credit those with my response of belief. So, faith is a rational response to the evidence. My first point of that, faith is not an extra rational mode of coming to knowledge and belief, but my second point of that, faith is rational conviction, that's true, but it's not certainty. That's the other thing that has come down to us through the ages over hundreds and hundreds of years, is that what makes faith kind of distinctive is that unlike ordinary belief and ordinary knowledge, where you know what you know and you pretty much think you know what you pretty much think you know. You might be right, you might be wrong, you think you're right. That's how ordinary knowledge typically operates. Faith, however, is supposed to have this shining quality of lending a kind of absolute ironclad certainty to what it is that you believe. So if you know something by faith, then there's no doubting. There's no contingency. There's no possibility that you would ever change your mind or ever go back on the belief. Well, my contention is the apostles don't have that in mind. They don't have it in mind that you believe it because it is certain to you. Rather, I think what they have in mind is you believe it because having looked at everything there is to look at, you think it's true. And you think it's true with enough conviction that you're going to base your life on it. You're going to bet your life on it. So you're betting your life on that which you know is true. Now, is there a logical possibility it's not true? Yeah. Is there the historical possibility that it's not true? Well, yeah. But you don't think so. You have seen enough, you know enough, you have put it in a context in your life in such a way that you're banking on it being true. And that's what faith is. That's what the belief that ultimately saves you is when you have that kind of belief relative to the claims of the gospel, the story of the gospel. Well, we can probably come back and talk about some of that a little bit. Second point under faith here is that the spiritual significance of faith, and anytime I use faith, understand that I could use the word belief. I'm using them synonymously. The spiritual significance of faith or belief arises from the connection between what I do embrace as true, which is an epistemological fact, a fact pertaining to my beliefs and knowledge. There's a connection between what I embrace as true and what I am willing to accept as true, which I would argue is a moral and spiritual fact, at least when we're talking about the gospel it is. That is, if I do not want to admit that something is true, I will rationalize why I do not believe it is true. Reason and evidence will not be compelling to the person who does not want to be compelled. And that's not an intellectual issue when it comes to the gospel and God. That's a moral, spiritual issue. If I don't want God to be relevant to my life, I won't believe that God is relevant to my life, and I will find a way using my intelligence to convince myself that I'm right in not believing that God is relevant to my life. That it took me years as a Christian to see how important that connection is to understanding the perspective of the apostles. It operates on other levels, more mundane levels, maybe not mundane levels, but it operates on more ordinary levels. It's just that it comes to the forefront when we're talking about the gospel. Let me give an example. If I were to go to a doctor and a doctor said, you're going to die in 3 months of cancer, I can respond in one of two ways. If I don't have some kind of dogged determination that it's not true that I die, then I just accept that this doctor knows what I'm talking about. I may get a second opinion, but when I get a second opinion, I'm open to the possibility that that second opinion is going to confirm the first opinion. But it's also possible, and there are people in the world who would respond to that by saying, I simply don't want it to be the case that I'm going to die in 3 months, so I refuse to believe that it's the case that I'm going to die in 3 months. This doctor doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm going to get a second opinion. And when the second opinion says you're going to die in 3 months, then medicine today doesn't know what it's talking about. And on and on and on, I'm just simply not going to believe that it's true because I don't want it to be true. Now, that's an extreme example when it comes to ordinary life, but it's been known to happen. The problem is when you get to issues like, is God there, and is God relevant, and is Jesus the Son of God, and did God send his Son into the world to judge the world as well as to save the world? I mean, when you get into those kinds of issues impinge upon our life in a way that other ordinary matters don't typically do. So, do I believe Australia exists? I do, but it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference, other than kiwi fruit and believing in mythological creatures like the duckbill platypus. It doesn't really impact my life much. So I don't really have any resistance to it. So I'm simply open to accepting the testimony of others and taking it at face value and taking it for granted. I mean, you go to the airport and there are signs that say leaving for Sydney. There seems to be all kinds of evidence around that it really must exist. And so I just accept it. I accept the evidence at face value and come to the conclusion. But if you had signs around saying God exists, we're not necessarily going to be open to the evidence in the same way as the existence of Sydney, Australia. We're not going to be open to it because every moment of my life is impacted by whether or not that's true, and it's impacted in a way that I'm not naturally positively inclined to like it. I'd prefer to be the center of the universe. God's making a claim to that spot, and frankly, I don't much like that. That interferes with my preferred way of looking at the world. God is a righteous God, and he expects righteousness from his creatures. I don't really much like that. So I would prefer for it not to be true. So there's all kinds of desires and passions and impulses and inclinations and orientations in me that are at war with what otherwise might be the evidence and the reasons and the arguments that I would respond to in facing the issue of does God exist? Is Jesus the Son of God? Was Jesus raised from the dead? And that kind of thing. Well, those moral, spiritual orientations and issues that I have are in the forefront when it comes to something as central to our lives as eternal truths about God and his purposes in the world. So that's where we see the battle. In principle, the battle could occur in the other areas of our life as well. But in very rare circumstances, only in very rare circumstances would they ever be an issue in the other areas of our life, because nothing else is really quite that relevant to how I live. But on spiritual issues, it becomes directly and immediately relevant to how I live, and I'm not going to believe what I don't want to believe. So it's that connection between the epistemology of how I know what I know and believe what I believe, and the morality and spirituality of who I am. Those are intimately tied together. And it's that's the key to understanding the whole doctrine that is taught in the New Testament, that we are justified by our believing. Let's go on here and look at what I have here. Accordingly, I say in point A, faith or belief is offered as a very important and sensitive litmus test of one's spiritual condition. Am I a child of God? Preach the gospel to me and see how I respond to it. If I respond receptively, with openness, with sensitivity to it, it can only be because I'm not morally and spiritually resistant to it. If I respond with hostility to it, it's because that's what's inside of me, is an inherent hostility to God and the things of God. And that manifests itself by my saying, I'm not going to believe it because I don't want it to be true, although I never put it that way. Well, not never. Every now and then people will be that honest, but normally they say, I don't believe it because, as Bertrand says, not enough evidence. But that not enough evidence is mostly a charade. That's not the reason I don't believe. It's not the lack of evidence that is my problem. It's my unwillingness to believe it. So it's that response of belief or unbelief that is this very sensitive litmus test to what's going on inside of me morally and spiritually. It is those who believe are children of God, who are justified, who will be granted life. Those who don't believe are children of the devil. They are not justified. They will not be granted life. Now, another, what in our context is going to be a controversial claim, faith is not the only indicator of one's status as a child of God, I would argue. It is the one that receives special emphasis throughout much of the New Testament, but it's not the only indicator that I'm a child of God, that I'm justified, that I'm going to receive life, that I am morally, spiritually open to the things of God. Several things follow from that. or are related to that, faith is not an infallible indicator of righteousness or as my standing as a child of God. The demons believe, the demons have faith, but they're not saved. It has to be, it's not merely intellectual assent that saves you, it's believing with my life. It's believing from the core of who I am. It's betting my existence on this being true. And what I mean by betting my existence on it is I'm prepared to live my whole life as if it is true and in the light of the fact that it's true. That's the faith that justifies, or the faith that saves. So somebody could talk like they believed. Somebody could dress like they believed. Somebody could eat like they believe. Somebody could do all kinds of things to kind of go through the motions of believing that the gospel is true and put on a good enough show that you and I are convinced that they believe. But that's not the issue. It's not going through the motions of believing that it's true that saves you. It's actually being someone who, at the core of who they are, have embraced the gospel as the truth, such that it changes how they live and how they look at the life. So that's true. Authentic faith would probably be a true and infallible indicator. But in practice, faith alone is not an infallible indicator, because we can go a long way toward faking faith. Also, arguably, faith is not an absolutely necessary condition of righteousness. And what I mean there is faith as we think of it, faith as we understand it, faith in the gospel, faith that Jesus is the Christ, faith that God raised Jesus from the dead. That's not an absolutely necessary precondition of righteousness. For example, you have all the people in Hebrews 11 from the Old Testament who are declared to be in faith, who don't have a clue about Jesus and his resurrection and his crucifixion and any of that about them. They believed what they believed, so the author of Hebrews describes them as being in the faith. They believed the promises of God. They took the promises of God seriously. They took God seriously. So they had all of the moral spiritual condition that made them open to the truth of God, and if they had ever had the opportunity, they would have been open to the claims of Jesus out of that same openness that they displayed in the context of their own life. But they themselves did not have the faith that you and I have today. Did you have a question?
I just wanted to, when you say the faith that we have, if you meant the greater misunderstanding of the word faith, or the faith that's synonymous with belief that you...
The faith that's synonymous with belief that we have today, knowing the truth about Jesus and who he is. And so. But, as I put here, it's not infallible, it's not absolutely necessary, but faith is a relatively immediate, accessible, and a dramatic litmus test of who we are and where we are at spiritually and morally. And therefore, I think that's why it's in the forefront of the apostles' teaching. Because it's relatively accessible in a way that the other traits that would define the child of God are not so accessible. Okay, the third point, I think I might have made this point before in the outline in a prior discussion, but it's not the act of faith that saves us. Rather, it's the spiritual reality that faith reflects that saves us. That is, it's the condition of the heart that leads to faith that is the thing that God is looking at and putting as the condition for me being justified in his eyes. It's not the act itself. I misunderstood that for years. My comprehension was that it was the actual doing of the act of believing that saves us. My fourth point, faith is not a matter of believing a prescribed set of orthodox beliefs. Rather, faith is an orientation toward the story of the gospel and what it implies. That's a very important, and again, should be largely controversial in our context, because we have had hundreds of years, thousands of years now, of having a conception of belief as being defined by a prescribed canon of doctrines that you subscribe to. And to the extent that you subscribe to those same doctrines, to that extent you are a believer, you are a Christian. If you in any way depart from that canon of doctrines, you are what we call a heretic, and everyone knows that heretics go to hell and burn in hell, and we should help them along the way. That's just been the mindset that has been infused in us for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And we're a little bit more civilized today. We don't burn heretics at the stake. We just ostracize them. But the fact is, we still have imbibed that attitude that you're going to measure the status of a person, the spiritual standing of a person, by a certain set of doctrines. And each different group is going to have a slightly different set of doctrines. Some will be shared by any tradition. Others will be peculiar to that tradition. But the one thing you can count on is we can measure your spiritual. I can measure your spirituality by how much you line up with my vision of orthodoxy, with my canon. That's just ingrained in us. So what I'm arguing instead is that the apostles' perspective is not that you have to believe certain doctrine. The apostles' perspective is you have to be the right kind of person. You have to be the kind of person, we haven't talked about it yet, the next topic is sanctification, but you have to be the kind of person who's being sanctified by God. And one of the striking marks of someone being sanctified by God is an openness they have to the truth about who Jesus is and what he came into the world to do and what he needed to do and basically the story that Jesus and the apostles tell us. It's openness to that story and an openness that is uninformed openness, not just gullibility, uninformed openness, and an openness that goes deep. That goes deep into my own self-concept, my own self-definition, the basic underlying foundational desires of my heart. If it's an openness that arises out of that, then you are a child of God. If in any way I'm not open to that truth because of the evil and hostility, the truth seething in my heart, then I'm not a child of God. And the mistake we make reading the apostles is when John comes along, for example, and says, who is the Antichrist but the one who denies that Jesus is the Son? We read that through the lenses of our creeds and orthodoxy and think that John is espousing a creed and he's saying it's just rock solid. If someone doesn't subscribe to this doctrine, then they're the Antichrist. But we're reading that into John, I would argue. That's not how he's thinking about it. The way he's thinking about it is he has real live people in mind when he writes that. He knows who they are. He knows what their agenda is. He knows what their spirit is. He knows why they are rejecting the doctrine. And he's assessing their spiritual condition as it gets immediately manifest through their hostility to the confession that Jesus is the Christ. But I think John would have a very, very radically different perspective towards someone who'd never heard of Jesus, and if you went up to him and said, do you think Jesus is the Christ? And they went, I don't know. He's not going to say, my goodness, you must be Antichrist. This is the spirit of Antichrist. Because their reason for not confessing it is ignorance, not hostility. They don't know enough to know whether they should respond to that in truth or not. That's a morally and spiritually different scenario than the one that John is writing to when he says that in his letter. Okay. So, corollaries to my last point there, it is not the clarity and accuracy of my grasp of the gospel that indicates my salvation. So, when it comes to theology and doctrine, we need to cut one another slack, I would argue. We're in process. We're learning, we're growing, we're changing our minds, we're coming across new Bible passages that create tension with the things we used to believe, and we're having to sort that stuff out and figure that stuff out, and we're all in a different place in that journey, so we need to cut one another some slack and not demand that you speak clearly and accurately what the apostles taught. You might get some stuff wrong. But it doesn't mean your heart is wrong. It doesn't mean you're wrong in your relationship to God. It just means you're not done yet. You got some things to learn. Or I've got some things to learn, as the case may be. That's always a possibility as well. Rather, as I say in B, it is the authenticity of my inner orientation toward and response to God and response to the story of His saving grace that indicates my salvation. Just another comment on the first point there. What's interesting in our church culture is how much we have adopt the strategy of expecting and listening for formulas. I mean, it's not even enough that you believe what I believe. You need to use the right words and phrases to say it, or you're somehow suspect. You can't even use your own language to define what it is that the apostles teach. And there's something wrong with that. I mean, that's desperately misguided. Okay, let me stop there for your comments and questions and have a discussion about faith. And
One of the first points about faith being a rational response and not necessarily this kind of shot in the dark based on some evidence. Is it true at church over the weekend, the pastor brought up Kierkegaard, who I know you're familiar with, I'm not. He said that Kierkegaard coined the term leap of faith. And the way I understand that is kind of that shot in the dark thing. Can you explain what Kierkegaard meant by a leap of faith?
Okay. What did the pastor say, just as a matter of curiosity?
It wasn't about that necessarily. It was just kind of a side note that said that that's kind of the final... We have to take a step out sometimes into unsurety. You know, we may have significant reason to believe, but something in our heart might say, I'm not sure, but we need to take that leap of faith. We need to step out, if you will, on a limb. Use the metaphor of Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade, where he steps out into the chasm.
Okay. Well, here's what Kierkegaard meant. Kierkegaard meant what I was just describing. The term actually was coined by a German philosopher named Lessing. And Lessing was not a believer. He was a agnostic, atheist kind of guy. And his claim was that I would love to believe. I really would love to be a Christian believer. But the problem is the evidence takes me this far, and to believe is over on the other side of this broad ditch. That is, the evidence leads me up to this ditch, but it can't lead me any further. There's this really big, broad ditch between me and faith, he said. And what he meant by that ditch was a lack of evidence, this serious lack of evidence that doesn't allow me to go all the way to faith. And he says, I can't, you know, I just, if I were to believe, I'd have to take this leap of faith and just jump over that gaping chasm of a ditch that stands between me and belief. So as a rational person, he was arguing, I just can't go there. I can't do that. Where Kierkegaard takes that up, and as Kierkegaard is, he's sort of smart alecky and ironic in much of what he says. So in an ironic sort of way, he says, you know, Lessing is absolutely right about that. He's absolutely right. And at first, it may sound like what he's saying is that he agrees that there's this big gaping abyss of lack of evidence that keeps you from coming to belief. But as you go on and look at what he says, he's not saying that at all. He eventually gets around to saying a phrase that I think is very telling for what he means by that. He says, any ditch is infinitely broad if you don't want to jump. That is, he says, it doesn't really matter whether it's a narrow ditch or a big broad ditch. It really doesn't make any difference. If you don't want to jump to the other side, any ditch is infinitely broad, he said. So for him, it was all about this issue. What Kierkegaard grasped, and I wish I had read him much earlier in my life. I missed out because I had written him off as an irrationalist. What he grasped, that it took me years to grasp, was this connection between what I believe, what I embrace, what I commit myself to intellectually or epistemologically. What I commit myself to intellectually is intimately linked to what I want, what I desire. So the leap of faith that he's talking about is the necessity of deciding that I want my life to be connected to what he calls the infinite. And what he means by that is God and the truth, the gospel, Jesus, the things of God, and so on. That if I don't want that, and no amount of evidence can make you want it, right? It's not that kind of decision. You're not deciding whether it's true, whether it's rational, whether it's reasonable, whether it's warranted or not. You're trying to decide whether you want it. Do I want my life to be about goodness? Do I want my life to be about righteousness? Do I want my life to be about truth? Do I want my life to be about God? Well, you kind of have to decide. You don't have to decide that. You can make it about pleasure and avoiding boredom and any number of things that we do in this life. You can make it about that if you want to. No one's stopping you. In your freedom, that's your choice to make. But until you make the choice that you want your life to be about the things of God, there's no amount of evidence that's going to make you jump the ditch to get from where you are to actual faith, to actual belief, to actual commitment to the truth of the gospel. In a nutshell, that's what he meant by it. And I think he's profoundly right. I mean, that's exactly right.
Yeah, it's severely misunderstood, I think, and understood the way that the agnostic guy really
right.
said it.
Exactly.
And that is, in fact, what we have to do as Christians is make this big leap, you know, at some point, and that doing that is meritable is in God's eyes. That gains us merit with God, that we would make that leap of faith to believe in him when maybe for whatever reason circumstances and evidence around us doesn't.
I think I'm following you, but let me feed it back and see it. Yeah, one standard way of looking at that is that people even read Kierkegaard this way, that somehow it's this great deal that believing in the truth of Christianity isn't very rational, and actually the evidence against it, in fact, any smart person would reject it. But lo and behold, God likes people who act stupid.
Right.
And so when we believe anyway against the evidence that there's some sort of grand virtue in that God rewards with eternal life, yeah. That's not what Kierkegaard is saying. Kierkegaard is just assuming that we can all accept the fact that Christianity is credited as true to a significant enough degree that's not the issue. That lack of evidence is not what's keeping us from belief. What keeps us from belief is this problem with what he calls our inwardness. We're not inwardly inclined to want God and the things of God, and that's our problem. Stephen?
So if I get this right, what I hear you saying is that it's the inner intention of the heart that is more important than the intellectual process or the relationship to the evidence and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Because when your first point A there, faith is a rational response to the evidence, I thought of countless examples of the Gospels where people believe with no evidence. And Jesus himself says, blessed are those who believe without seeing. So it's kind of wonderful. What's the role of evidence then? Why is this a response to rational response to evidence?
Well, when you say
all this indication of people believing outside of any kind of context of evidence.
Okay, well, the quote comes from Thomas, right? Blessed are those who see or who believe though they have not seen.
Well, he also talks about people believing in miracles and signs and wonders, and there's all kinds of ways that people are testing Jesus, and he says, "Go get it. It's not about stuff." So it seems, and they didn't have the internet. I mean, people were coming out of the woodwork, and they didn't have an abundance of evidence necessarily, but they were coming from some kind of a movement of the heart or the spirit or something.
Okay, well, we'd almost have to take each and every one of those instance that you're talking about, take each one of them and talk about them. What I would argue is that I think that's to misconstrue what's going on in each and every one of those cases. Because I don't think we have, the Gospels don't advocate believing against or without evidence. What Paul and the apostles are continually, what Jesus and the apostles are continually harping on is you have the evidence and yet you're acting like you don't. For example, one of those passages is where Jesus says a wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign. I think is how it gets quoted. Well, but if you remember the scene, Jesus has just finished performing some miracles, and these Pharisees come up to him and say, "Tell you what, Jesus, do a miracle and then we'll believe." And, you know, reading between the lines, you can see Jesus going, "What were those? I mean, where have you been? I mean, he's just been performing miracles. He just in front of their very eyes cast out a demon of a deaf mute man, and he could now hear and speak." And then that's when they come to him and say, "Well, just show us a sign." And I don't think he says it right away, but eventually when he says, literally, I mean, I think it should be translated not a wicked and perverse generation seeks for a sign, but rather I think what he's saying is, this is a wicked and perverse generation that is asking for a sign. I mean, he's assessing the spiritual state and announcing what the spiritual state of this generation of Jews is. To him, I don't think he's making a blanket statement that any generation anywhere who ever asks for a sign is wicked and perverse. I don't think that's what he means by that. He's saying the reason I'm not going to give you a sign is because you are a wicked and perverse generation.
So you're proposing that when there's instances of belief, it's as a result of evidence? Like
yes.
The centurion who sent a servant to go get Jesus to heal his child.
Right.
You're assuming then that he actually has some evidence,
right,
based on previous activities and observations and that kind of thing, not just
exactly.
This must be, you know, something big.
Well, at a minimum, at that point in Jesus' ministry, people were coming from the whole eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean to come to Jesus. His reputation had become so extensive that you had people coming from Syria, from all over, to be healed by him. Well, the centurion lived right there in Galilee. So he's right in the thick of this thing going down. He's heard all kinds of eyewitness testimony and maybe has even been an eyewitness to some of the miracles himself. That's not inconceivable. So then when he has need, he says, "I want, go get Jesus for me." But I don't think that's out of the blue. He's responding because he believes that credible reports have come to him about this strange man who's able to heal people.
I suppose what I'm responding to is the sense that maybe he wanted to believe. And this gets to the sense kind of in the charismatic world of, you know, it's really all about your state of belief, not so much about evidence. And it's an assumption about the centurion. We don't know from the story what he really did know. But between maybe the Christian culture today and maybe inaccurate reading or careful reading or whatever it is, there's a sense that people are measured in their faith by what they want to believe. Mm-hmm. This plays into the whole idea of, you know, getting the first answer to something. Mm-hmm.
I said this was controversial, but I would just argue that that's not what you ever find in the Gospels. Take the centurion, for example. When Jesus goes on to have a conversation with him and he marvels at his faith, notice what he's marveling at. He doesn't marvel at the fact that he believes that his child is going to be healed. What he marvels at is the centurion's explanation. "I'm a man under authority. I know what it's like to tell people to do things and they do it." And that's what Jesus responds to. Nowhere in Israel have I seen faith like this man. I think what he's responding to, as is always the case when Jesus marvels at somebody's faith, What he's marveling at is how well they have come to understand the significance of Jesus' miracles in that they are a sign to him being the Christ under the authority of God, that this is the one sent from God. So it's their believing that he's the Son of God that they're marveling at, not the fact that they want somebody healed. And I think if you look at those accounts carefully, you'll notice that that's the pattern throughout all of them. And take the statement, blessed are you because you believe because you have seen, blessed are those who believe even though they have not seen. That's to Thomas, but notice how much tradition has distorted the significance of Thomas' confession, because Thomas is not, he comes down as doubting Thomas, but Thomas has not evidenced an ounce of doubt that none of the other disciples did not evidence before him. The thing that's unique about Thomas is he wasn't there when Jesus showed up before. He hasn't seen him yet. But every one of, with the possible exception of John, and with the possible exception of some of the women, with the possible exception of them, every one of the other disciples, it is reported in the Gospels that when the women came and reported back that Jesus was raised from the dead, they didn't believe them. I mean, they in effect said, until I stick my fingers in the prints in his hands and in his side, I will not believe. I'm just not going to believe just because you tell me. And now all of a sudden, everybody comes back and tells Thomas that Jesus was raised from the dead, and he says, I'm not going to believe till I see him. Well, he's not taking any attitude that all of them haven't taken before him. So his doubt is not unusual. What, if anything, is unusual, it's his confession. And I'm not sure, because I don't know what to make of that. But Thomas says, my Lord and my God. And perhaps recognize the significance of the relationship between the Messiahship of Jesus and the incarnation, the deity of Jesus, in a way that has not been grasped until then. But I think that's what's remarkable, is his confession, not his doubt. His doubt was pretty ordinary. So when Jesus says to him, you believe because you see, blessed are those who believe though they have not seen, Jesus is simply kind of musing on the problem that you and I are going to have down in history. We don't have the luxury of satisfying our doubts by putting our fingers in the prints in his hands and in his side. And he's saying it's going to, basically I think what he's saying is it's going to take a miracle that anybody beyond you guys believe. It actually takes a miracle that they believe to start with, but it's going to take a miracle that anybody in history believes this stuff, because they don't have the luxury of being able to get firsthand evidence for themselves like you guys have. So they're blessed if they believe. But he's not saying by that, you turkeys, you had to have evidence. Your faith is no good. But those guys that are coming that believe without the evidence, they're really cool. I don't think that's what he's saying. I don't think he's saying that there's somehow some virtue that we have that they didn't have. He's just recognizing that because we are rational creatures who respond to the evidence and need the evidence, we have an obstacle in front of us that the first generation didn't have. And he recognizes that that's a problem. And so I think he's crediting our rationality when he does that. He's crediting our rationality by acknowledging, yes, that's a problem. Whereas if his view of faith was, my faith has nothing to do with rationality, then the lack of evidence is no obstacle to faith. But he's recognizing it is an obstacle to faith, which I think means that he recognizes the connection. Yeah?
One more.
Okay.
I'm just going to pose this as a problem and ask you what you think of it.
Okay.
If faith is a rational response to the evidence, and the average modern American receives the evidence in the form of the modern church with all of its theological errors,
through its teaching and
obviously formality and all that kind of stuff, then how do you if they're making a rational response to the evidence that's represented as the gospel, that may not be an accurate set of evidence. So what do you make of that?
Well, I don't think... Okay.
If you associate the gospel with this thing,
right,
and this thing doesn't make sense to you, you reject the gospel on the basis of the evidence. It's a problem.
Okay, well, this is going to sound a little outrageous, but I think it's true that because of the very problem that you point out, sometimes unbelief is a marker that you're a child of God.
I can put seven.
I mean, if you understand what I'm saying, that if you get a very, very perverse distortion of the truth through certain Christian traditions, then the same sanctification that makes us open to God and the truth about God would make us closed to a perverse form of that, to a perversion of that. And so my resistance to believe could very well be a mark of my sanctification, a mark that God is drawing me to himself. Now, we'd have to talk about particular cases, but in principle, that seems true. I think the fact of the matter is that God is not confined to using churches. There's no obstacle to God getting us to confront the truth in a form that is accurate enough that I can respond to it one way or the other. My brother tells a story of when he was in Russia. He studied in Leningrad twice, and when he was in Leningrad the first time, he met a man who had become a believer by going to the Museum of Atheism in Leningrad. And he would scour all of the literature on atheism, looking, they would occasionally quote the Bible in order to debunk it and talk about how ridiculous it was. Well, he would just glean what he could of the Bible out of all this literature on atheism, having first become a believer by reading Dostoevsky. So, you know, he lived in a culture that was trying like crazy to keep anybody from becoming a believer, but he found a way. So I just think God finds a way to get the truth to us when he wants us.
I was just going to say that the evidence isn't necessarily the gospel or specifically the misrepresentation thereof. That's not the soul.
Right.
I mean, as Romans points out, that God has made himself plain to man through creation, and
right,
there's lots more evidence than church's theology.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Isn't it true that in a sense that the more you believe, the more your belief makes sense, and belief seems like the most natural thing to you, maybe, as you continue to believe?
If you're saying this, I don't think that's right, and this is what I'm afraid you're saying, that, well, first of all, the doubt, whenever the Bible talks about doubt, the doubt that it's talking about as being a kind of dangerous thing to us is not intellectual doubt. I don't think it ever proposes intellectual doubt as a danger to us. Intellectual doubt is our friend, I would argue. That when I have intellectual doubt, it means that something isn't coherent. Something's not fitting. Something's not right. And I have some work to do on understanding the truth, and it's doubt that gets me moving and keeps me from ossifying in my false beliefs. So doubt is actually a very good, intellectual doubt is a very positive thing in our life. The doubt that is deadly is when I am of two minds, I'm uncertain about whether I want my life to be about God and the things of God, that I'm wavering there. Do I want to sink my life into the stuff of this world, or do I want to live for eternity serving God? Well, we can have doubts with respect to what we want to do, how we want to define our own existence. That's deadly, because there's really only one right answer to that one, and we just need to get that one right. We need to invest our lives in God and the things of God, and do so unwaveringly, without hesitation. So whenever you run across doubt in the New Testament, maybe there are exceptions to this, but in all those significant passages where it talks about it, that's what it's talking about. What I was afraid that you were saying was that there's some kind of moral obligation that we have when we have intellectual doubt about some things in our faith, that we just need to crank up the juices and believe anyway. And I don't think so. I don't think there's ever any virtue in that. If I'm uncertain, I'm uncertain. If I don't get it, I don't get it. If I'm not sure it's true, I'm not sure it's true. And it's true, I can, in a way, make myself believe it anyway. But if I make myself believe it anyway, that kind of forced belief is not authentic belief anyway. So what good is it? I mean, if it has to be happening for real in order for it to even count in the first place. So the way to address doubts, intellectual doubts about the faith, is to look at the evidence, look at the arguments, look at, to ponder, consider, weigh, you know, just ask myself the question, what makes sense to me and why and should it make sense to me? And just keep working at that. But not being afraid if I can't land right now.
So how do you deal with doubts in the heart?
About what I want? That's a tough one. I just, only God has access to that. Only God and me have access to that. So really, the only thing I can do is say, God, I don't know if I want the right things. Save me. Save me from my own desires. Save me from these ungodly passions. Change me.
Back to your the comment about that God can, in a sense, save me wherever I am.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent do you think we should sweat what's going on in those of us whose churches we feel are maybe a little off?
I don't think we need to sweat it, but we can have compassion on everybody, and to the extent, I mean, I really see most of evangelical Christendom today very much the same way Paul looked at synagogues of his day. They are a very likely field for evangelism. If you're going to find people who are likely to hear and understand the gospel, there's some people in those churches that are likely open and ready and will be receptive to it. There are a lot of them that won't be. Just like the synagogues, most of them rioted and tried to kill Paul, but there were a few who were responsive. And he expected that there would be people among them that would be responsive. So that was the first place he would go in town, is to see who there is ready to listen. And that's kind of how I see the churches. What better place to go to find out somebody who's ready to listen than someone who's interested enough to go where they talk about God, at least, or at least pretend to talk about God. So it's a likely place to find people that are open to the truth.
The angle I was coming from was I felt like, as long as I've attended the church, the reason I was one of these people who, through their unbelief, is saved in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so, once I realized what was going on in my church, I felt like I had to leave it to be able to get a grip on the truth. And my initial reaction was, oh my gosh. How can I have been doing that for that long,
mm-hmm.
and not have any sort of grip on the message? And it just seemed so entirely wrong.
Mm-hmm. And you got a bit angry.
I got angry.
Yeah.
And I've
been there, done that.
That would be uncomfortable, including myself. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of the angle I'm coming from. It felt like, how many people are like me that are sitting there going,
yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to keep believing even though it doesn't make any sense because I got to keep believing because that's what they keep telling me to do.
Yeah, those are the people that I just think we need to have the compassion to want to reach out to them and evangelize them. And start making sense to them in a way that you'll be like a breath of fresh air to them. And they'll just suck it up. Because none of this has ever made any sense to them, really. But yet there's something deep inside that tells them, but this is the truth. I mean, that's how I was as a college student. You know, I was immersed in this church culture, in this Christian culture, and nothing about it was particularly interesting or attractive to me, but there was this nagging hold that it had on me because somehow Jesus is the truth. I mean, that's the truth. So I can't walk away from it. So I was just desperately wanting somebody to make sense out of it for me. And I think there's a lot of people in our churches that are like that, and we need to find them and help them.
Do you feel like the Great Commission has been mistaught in the church? I'm thinking about when you talked about how some people, their hearts are just automatically accepted of the gospel, and some people are just rejected. And I've always felt as a Christian that it's my responsibility that every person I come in contact with that I can witness to, that it's my job to get them saved no matter what. And I just always felt this guilt, you know, because it seems like the majority of people I talk to are more want to get in a debate over it rather than just, you know, tell me more about what you believe. And so it's always just been such a struggle to me and something that I just don't want to do, but I felt this burden to do it.
Right.
So what do we do as Christians with that and what you said?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yes, I think it has been mistaught because we have had a lot of guilt dumped on us that it's your fault that they're going to go to hell. Their blood is on your hands if you don't tell them. God is not going to miss anybody. Everybody he plans on saving is going to get saved. I mean, that's just as clear to me from Paul's teaching. It's just a privilege that we ever get to be a midwife to their spiritual birth. I mean, I don't evangelize because if I don't do it, they're doomed. I would do it because what greater joy in the world is there than to be a part of God's working this eternal miracle in their life and have me be there to witness it and to be a part of it. I love that scene where Jesus is talking to the woman at the well in Samaria and the disciples have gone off to get some Burger King at the village. And he's talking to her, and there's just this incredible interchange where she comes to realize that this man is from God. And then she runs back to the village as the disciples come back, and they said, "We've got some food." And his comment, "I have food you know not of." I think what he's saying by that is, what I've just been doing is much better than eating. I mean, this is the food for my soul to be used by God in this particular way. I think that should be our perspective on evangelism, is not that God needs me to do this for them so that they can get saved. I mean, if we don't speak, the rocks will cry out. I mean, if we don't speak, they'll read a book by Bertrand Russell and become a Christian. I mean, if we don't speak, something else is going to get, God will get through to them. God doesn't need me. But it's just this tremendous privilege to be able to enter into a relationship with someone and see God do this miracle of calling them to himself and then receiving the invitation. So there's actually something else I was going to say in answer to your question. I can't remember. I guess I basically said it, that, we're not going out to make disciples because God can't do without us. We're going out to make disciples because that's just part of his gift to us, I think. I know what I was going to say. When I recognize that, then I can relax in my relationship with people. There are people who have the personality, and I wish I had that personality, but there are those people who have the personality who can come up to somebody and begin talking to them about eternal judgment and truth and condemnation and all that kind of stuff in an inviting kind of way that is not off-putting and doesn't seem like this bizarre non sequitur. How's the weather? Well, have you heard of Jesus? You know? And some people can do that, but I'm not one of those people. And so if someone is not asking the question, I'm not providing an answer. And I'm just counting on on the relationship that I forge with them in life, hopefully making them curious about what makes me tick and beginning to ask questions about that. But if it doesn't, it doesn't. And I'm not going to force it. But there's nothing I'd rather do than talk about this stuff. There's nothing I'd rather do than evangelize. It's the most wonderful experience in the world. But evangelism is one thing, you know, being an obnoxious, bizarre person is an entirely different thing, and that's not evangelism. Ken?
It's probably just kind of repeating what you just said, but that I think that's so true that the Christian culture has this tradition of this burden doing this, and it gives people just, and I know for myself, it's like this feeling like this is my job as a Christian. And anytime I'm face to face with someone new, it's like, I've got to find this opening. I've got to, you know, do this. And like you say, it comes out sounding just really bizarre. I mean, but from the coming around to this perspective that it is in God's hands, totally makes, like just what you said, that if they're asking about it, that's going to come up. Or I've noticed, you know, the more that this is just something I'm trying to figure out and then process with in my own self, even though that doesn't sound right in the traditional Christian way. We're not supposed to think about ourselves, we're supposed to think about other people. But when I'm thinking about myself in relationship to the gospel and everything, and that's just kind of what's going on, then, like, I have a friend I talk to sometimes, and it seems like every time I'm talking, something comes up about my faith. It's just the relationship we have, but it's not planned, and it's not, like you say, there's this freedom. It's not a burden anymore like that. It's what's in my life, and it's something that just naturally comes out.
Right.
Still probably helping one another, but not in the same way.
Like St. Bobby says, the times they are changing. There used to be a time when my role as a pastor or a Bible teacher would get me some traction. That, you know, I'd be meet some stranger and they say, "What do you do?" "I'm a pastor." And they go, "Ah, that's interesting. I have a question." You know, and we'd get into some conversation. But in recent times, they can't change the topic fast enough when they find out that I'm a Bible teacher or a pastor. It's really different.
How should we understand the Great Commission then? It's, in my experience, it's been taught as like a pillar of basic. It's one of two things that all Protestants have in common: the Great Commandment and the Great Commission. You know, to love your brother and love God, and to go ye unto all the world and preach the gospel. I mean, if we hold any two things in common, that's what Protestants hold in common. My assumption is that after a reading of that, is that the Great Commission was addressed to the apostles only and not necessarily to the whole New Testament church through the ages. Is that how you read it?
Yeah, I do think it's a particular charge and instruction to the apostles, because they were literally to go into the world and proclaim it. I mean, I think basically he was saying, scatter now, you guys, and take this to the world. If I take it literally to heart as an individual, then I need to take it to the world, right? Which means I need to uproot and move, become an overseas missionary or something like that, which when I was growing up, that is the way that got taken. I mean, the really spiritual people were the ones that became missionaries back in the 1950s. Well, that's not what he's saying. I mean, that's not a charge to every believer. I mean, we know that because in 1 Corinthians, Paul's point is, stay in the condition in which you have been called, he says. You're a slave? Stay a slave, unless you can get free. Are you married? Stay married. If you're not married, don't have to get married. I mean, there's nothing about becoming a believer now that demands that you change your social, economic situation. That is there anything that he's telling the apostles there that's relevant to us? Yeah, I think so. And that is, what's the most important service that we can do for mankind in the world today? Make them disciples of Jesus. I mean, I think that's true. And to the extent that that's the underlying intuition behind our, you know, holding up the Great Commission, I think that's right. I think it's fundamentally right, our intuition as evangelicals, that there really isn't anything more important that you can give a person than a relationship with Jesus.
I have a question for you. Do you think there's a measuring stick in evangelism today about people who are seen as more spiritual because they speak in tongues?
In some traditions, in some groups, yes, that's true.
What is your perspective on that?
I don't think that's right. That's what I would argue is actually the argument of 1 Corinthians 12 through 14, is that what's happening there is, as I would read it, what's happening in Corinth is this phenomenon is happening that they are calling speaking in tongues. I don't think it actually was speaking in tongues. It probably was what linguists call glossolalia. And so the Corinthians were practicing glossolalia, but calling it speaking in tongues. And Paul is writing to them, and if you notice, read chapter 12 of 1 Corinthians and the way he starts it, really the issue for him is about spirituality. They are claiming that they are more spiritual because they are speaking in tongues. And Paul's whole argument there is, look, the height of spirituality is confessing that Jesus is the Lord. You can't get any more spiritual than that, he's saying. So he's just basically calling into question, so what's this more spiritual stuff? I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me, because it's a miracle that any of us actually believe that Jesus is the Lord and confess it to be true. That's the miracle of miracles, that the Spirit of God comes into our life to produce. So then he's going on basically to criticize them for having this, what he thinks is a very immature and even pagan notion of spirituality that they've adopted, that spirituality is losing control and being possessed by someone outside of yourself and so speaking ecstatically out of control and stuff like that. It has the earmarks of being spiritual because it seems like I've been taken over by someone else, namely the Spirit of God. But Paul is challenging that and saying that view of spirituality is completely wrong, is completely misguided. So there are traditions, I would argue, within Christendom today who have that same pagan view of spirituality at the heart of their concept of spirituality.
Is faith something quantifiable?
Faith?
Does some people have more faith than others? Do we expect to grow in our faith as we mature? And then Jesus, for example, recommended his disciple, little you men, little faith. And then you have faith as a mustard seed. I was feeling that we compare our faith as though this concept that faith moves God to action. That if you have lots of faith, things would happen. Mm-hmm. And things don't happen because you have a little bit of faith. What's your perspective on that?
Okay. I think you can meaningfully talk in quantitative terms, although it's not quantifiable, but I think you can meaningfully speak in quantitative terms like more or less growing in faith, increasing in faith. And what they would mean by that would be my relationship with God is a process. And I start off having this fundamental intuition that somehow this is true. And I commit myself to it. Oftentimes, I should have said this earlier, oftentimes the reason it seems plausible to us that faith is believing not on evidence, the reason that seems plausible to us is because most of us in our experience believed and committed and embraced a gospel that we didn't even really altogether understand yet. And we certainly hadn't weighed the evidence. That just wasn't the way we did it. But what I would argue is that's misleading, because rationality works not only at an articulate conscious level, but at an intuitive, unconscious, subconscious level. And I would argue that the reason we felt justified in doing that is because we had this rational intuition that this really was true. That's what I was describing when I was in college. I had this rational intuition that this Jesus guy was where it was at, even though most of the stuff that went along with it didn't make any sense to me. But something told me there's truth there. I couldn't have articulated to you what was compelling to me, but it was compelling to me. It was only over the course of my life that I began to be able to articulate to myself, this is why this is compelling to me. So we spend the rest of our life growing in our catching up, really, with our own intuitions, being able to spell out and articulate what it is that we already see. Sorry, I sidetracked myself. Okay. So we start off, however, with a faith that's somewhat tenuous and fragile and destructible. And over time, it becomes fortified. It becomes stronger. it becomes, to a point where there comes a point in my life where I really reach a point of no return. I mean, I think I've reached the point of no return in my life. I mean, this is just too true for me to back out on it now. I mean, it doesn't make any sense for me to go anywhere else. And I think that's what the Bible, the New Testament describes as a faith that is teleos. They usually translate that mature, but that's reached its goal, that's reached its end, is I'm not just coming to belief any longer. I like believe. I'm kind of stuck. I'm kind of here to stay. So when you reach that point of no return, your faith has matured. But even then, it can still grow. What you would mean by grow there would be I know more, I understand more, more fits together, becomes more coherent. I see more, I'm more perceptive about what my faith implies and so on. That's still growing. You also ask about...
Yeah. The second part about the roots or the misconceptions that if I had more faith and maybe God would answer my prayers or I would expect to see more, I must not have enough faith.
Yeah, that comes out of what I call Star Wars theology. It's the one I grew up with in a lot of ways. The one I was taught in college is, I just picture Luke Skywalker being trained by Yoda there in the swamp, and you know he just musters up faith and the spaceship starts to levitate out of the swamp, and then he loses it and it crashes down in the swamp, and then he just, you know, he. And that's oftentimes not quite so crass, but that's the conception of faith that we often sort of absorb from the other Christians around us. Nothing like that is what the apostles have in mind, I don't think. It's just belief. It's not energy. It's not an energy force. It's not something that I can have with more or less intensity. It's not focused consciousness. It's not a state of consciousness. It's just, I think this stuff's true. And because I think it's true, I'm going to base my life on it.
Luke was Peter, and Yoda was Jesus in the boat. He got out, he
yes.
didn't have faith, and
yeah.
he started to sink, and he lost
okay.
faith.
Okay.
There is direct correlation.
Right. That's right. You can read that account exactly like the scene. But I would argue that's not what's going on there. I don't think Peter was sinking. It's not clear to me that he was sinking. He just became afraid. And it's his fear, it's to his fear that Jesus responds, "Oh, you have little faith," or however he responds. Because Peter has all the evidence he needs, like how many meters of not sinking, of evidence that he's not going to sink, that God is fully capable of keeping him from drowning. And yet all of a sudden, I think what happened is there was a surge of waves and wind that splashed up over his thighs or, you know, something that all of a sudden freaked him out. And then he cries out, "Jesus, save me." And Jesus has just responded to him, "Peter, you weren't sinking. Why don't you believe that you are going to make it? If God took you this far, he's going to drown you now? That doesn't make any sense, Peter." And so he's faulting him for allowing his fears to overcome what he should know is true, is overcome what it is that he should rationally know, that God has every intention of bringing him to Jesus. But it reads like the loss of faith and the loss of concentration is making him sink into the thing. But I think if you look at the account, the Greek doesn't have to be translated that way, and I don't think that's what it means. I think they just the water washed up over his thighs.
I have to disagree with you, however, there is the motif that your faith has made you well. He did not do very many miracles in a certain spot because of the lack of faith.
Mm-hmm.
The woman with the issue, but you know, when he said, "Who touched me?" Somebody specifically touched me. I felt an hour go up. There seems to be a dynamic that can't be called mechanical that I don't really understand.
Okay.
You know, I resist myself the idea of faith being anything mechanical. You know, anything but a child before his father. But do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And what's your perception of that?
Well, again, we'd have to look at each of those individual accounts to look at what's going on there. In the case of the woman who touches his garments, I think God is simply reaching out to that woman where she's at. She does have a perspective that there's something magical going on here, that all she needs to do is touch his garment and she'll be saved. And she herself probably has a bit of a magical cast to her beliefs, instead of what happens is God honors her belief that Jesus is the Messiah and ignores her bad theology, instead of focusing on her bad theology and saying tough. If you see what I'm saying.
But that would seem to be promoting bad theology.
Well, right.
You know, with his words. I felt
power.
Cool power.
Yeah.
Is what it was.
Right. Well, that's right. He risks being reinforcing wrong belief there. That's true. But I just don't think God is that neat and tidy. He's not afraid of that kind of thing. He's got the rest of her life to fix her theology. But what he wants her to see is, you are right. I mean, remember, Jesus commends her for her faith. But I don't think her faith was, that's a mighty magical garment you've got on there, Jesus. I mean, I don't think that's her faith. Her faith is, this is the Son of God. And so he honors her faith, her belief, her commitment to his identity as the Son of God in a way that's going to be meaningful to her, that's going to translate to her. In the passages like in Nazareth where he won't do miracles because they don't believe, it's not that he can't do miracles because they lack the faith. It's that he will not. And the passage I quoted earlier where he says, this is an evil and a wicked and perverse generation asking for a sign. And he explains to them why he's not going to give a sign to an evil and perverse generation in that weird, weird little fable that he tells. And without getting into it, I would argue that in that the weird little fable that he tells there is sort of an allegorical fable. And the purpose of the fable is basically to explain allegorically the hardening effect of things like signs and truth on a hard heart. The problem with proclaiming the truth and continuing to proclaim the truth and continuing to throw in the face of an unbeliever the evidence that he's the Son of God is that they can only remain in their unbelief by steeling their heart against it. And he's not going to be doing them any favor by making them steel their heart against the truth. So if they haven't already responded to the evidence that's been given to them, he's going to stop giving them evidence because it doesn't do them any good. It damages them rather than opens them up. That's what he's saying to them. So I think what Jesus is saying is, if the Spirit of, I mean, Luke describes it at one point, that the Spirit of God was not present with him to perform miracles. That's the language he uses. But Jesus' own assessment of that is, God has his purposes, God has his agenda, and he knows what God is doing well enough to know that if the Spirit of God is not present with him to perform miracles, it's because they're not receptive to the truth, and doing miracles would only harden them further and not do them any favor.
I know that there are passages where the English phraseology is that he could not do any miracles because of the...
Okay.
Have you looked at the Greek?
I don't recall the passage exactly, so I'd have to go look at that. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're out of time, so we'll go on to sanctification next week.